This interview is being conducted for Alaska Native Tribal Health Consortium project number AN08-NJ7. The interviewer is Sarah Corbin.
James Rowan Sr. is assisting with the interview.
James Williams is being interviewed. Today is April 23rd, 2012. The interview is being conducted at 11:30 in the morning in Kluwak at the tribal office.
Welcome to a community of Kluwak.
Well, thank you very much. I'm pleased to be here.
Not very often people get this opportunity to talk to the outsiders of our community.
Shall we resume?
Okay.
Okay. So we'll start out with if you can tell me how long you've resided in Kluwak.
How long I've been resided in Kluwak? Mm-hmm. Oh my gosh, I was born here.
What year was that?
Classified, I can't tell you.
Shall I stop the recording?
No, I was born April 14th, 1939.
Have you lived in Kluwak your whole life?
No, during the time I was a teenager, my last schooling days was next door building, the bunkhouse. See, our school burnt down, and we started to go to school in these buildings here. And believe it or not, this was our classroom in the 50s. And after we finished here, eighth grade, and we went to government school. We went to the government school high between California and here. And then got married and moved to Montana for about 10 years. Kept going back and forth between Montana and here to go commercial fishing and construction. So during that time in California, we, Alaska became, you know, the Land Claim Settlement Act, okay? And we were excluded, people that left their hometowns. And so we organized the 13th Regional Corporation. There's 12 up here already established. And we organized our own. So we had 11 different states where all our people, through military and all that. And so we got that organized. And to this day it's still operating. But back in 85, 84, something like that, I came back home and that was it. And been here ever since. The guy that we're going to have funeral service for tonight, my good friend Leonard Cato, he came up to me one time and he said, why don't you stay home now and get involved with the A&B? And I said, really? Because I had no intentions of coming back, because we left this community, there was nothing. Our biggest check was the welfare check, and that was $300. So every time they came, boy, it was a big day. So I didn't want to come back here because there was nothing there. I was already established. I had a house, I had a job, I was involved, and they, man, they say, why should I come back to Kluwak? There's nothing here. That was my, so, but when Leonard said, hey, we're getting established, we're going to get this, we're going to get that, I came back. And my cousin, Richard Carl Jr., Boggy we call him, it's his nickname, he said, hey, why don't you join the tribal? He says, I'm going to step out. You could take my place. So that's when I took his place, and that's how we got involved.
Can you tell me about how Tlaloc was settled?
How Tlaloc was settled? Mm-hmm. Some of the elders talked with me, you know, like Elwood Thomas and, my grandpa, Jim Jackson, and stuff. He said that they came over, you know, by the lake, over the mountains. They saw all the activity, the species and stuff like that. Different animals, different sea animals and stuff like that. And they said, wow, this is it. And they looked at the creek and they saw how the creek produces. And they said, this is going to be a good place for us to settle down. And that was where they, just on the other side of the first walls, there's a totem pole that was established, and that was the first Tlaloc. And my gosh, it just, they saw the fishing industry, a tremendous amount of fish that used to come in here. And believe me, I participate and saw when it used to return. Oh, you could practically walk across. You just hear it when they came back. I mean, it was just awesome. And, it was just, we were just so fortunate to have all the species around us. And that was what they saw. So that was why they came out and they said, okay, they're going to teach us how to protect it, preserve it, and, don't overkill it.
And when did this part of Tlaloc, when did people start building their homes here?
In the 40s, late 30s, something like that, they started, as you could see it in B. Hall, there's plaques up there that give the history of all the things that started in this community. It's in the Ainby Hall. And I think it was almost the 1800s, something like that. That's when they started building around here. As you could see, there's pictures right now up at the City Hall of the first cannery, the state of Alaska. And then the island where I was born, that was, you know, in the neighborhood of 25 houses of that place. And then the rest of the area started building up. And you could see the evidence. You could see the evidence around the island here where the big trees were taken down, so where they could build. They had their own sawmill here.
What about people coming down from Texarkana?
Oh, Texarkana. Mm-hmm. Texarkana, yeah. That was one of the first villages, Tlingit villages, was established. Okay? And then they started migrating from Texarkana to here to build the town. So, and that was in the neighborhood of, I think, probably the 1800s, around there. So, I remember traveling with my dad when we were going from Texarkana to here. I was born in 39, and so they must have been the big camp was up there, and you could still see it to this day. But I could remember traveling on the boat back and forth, 30, 40, 42, yeah. And he started to build the house right there. By then, they already had the thought of the park was being established, the school, they started to build a school. So a lot of that was in that neighborhood.
Was that like during the fishing seasons when you traveled back and forth?
Yeah.
So can you tell me about the seasonal activities that took place in what's in this present part of Klawock?
Oh, all the different seasons?
Yeah, what sort of activities did people do and when did they do it? So maybe about the fishing or collecting of eggs or things like that, or drying of seaweed, stuff like that. What happened around this area of Bayview Boulevard, and what time of year would people do that activity?
Well, when during my time, you know, the 45, 47 in that neighborhood, you know, we would, springtime, the herring would start coming back, okay, and everybody would go out to the fishing island and plant their trees and get their kelp and bring it home. And so then there was another place they call Hole in Wall. The first sign of school being out, everybody would migrate out to the Hole in Wall and start putting up their tents, their smoke houses and stuff like that, to where they'll stay out there for 4 months, the whole summer, to put up their subsistence and all that.
Where is Hole in Wall?
Oh, it's about 3 hours to 2.5 hours straight out towards the ocean.
It's right on the edge of the ocean. You know where Roller Bay is? Kind of out in that area.
Yeah, one of the islands out there. But that was where everybody, Craig, Klawock, and Heidelberg, would have a piece of the island out there, and they would establish their camps out there. And that was where we done a lot of our subsistence.
What other activities would happen on the beach here at Klawock? Or in what now in the area that's now Bayview Boulevard?
Oh, the first sign of the ice breaking and stuff like that, you know, people would start getting prepared to go out and get sea cucumbers, shell clams and stuff like that, halibut and greens and stuff like that.
Do you know if there are any stories about Russian or Spanish or American traders coming through here?
At that time, we always heard about what was taking place up in Sitka area, you know, and the Russians mostly were concentrating on the sea otter and stuff like that, you know. We were commercial fishermen down here. We were, you know, we just concentrated in our area. In other words, I was taught to learn our area, how to conduct ourselves when we get on a fishing boat, and, you know, side drinking. And then once we learned that, then we went on to the big boats, like the ones that you see down here. So.
Okay.
We weren't loggers, we were fishermen, you know, that's all they taught us.
Hmm. Do you remember Bayview Boulevard being built or reconstructed or any work being done to it?
At that time when, like I said, you know, we were little teenagers and stuff like that, and I was on the crazy list, you know what I mean. I can remember when they had boardwalks, real narrow boardwalks, when, we used to crawl underneath the boardwalks and look for money. Because, you know, a lot of our uncles, brothers, and, you know, grandpas, everybody dropped change, and we'd be, and that was where we'd get our allowances. And I could remember when the tide used to come up and be right in the, on the road, and our boardwalk would be all through, would be underwater.
The tide came right up to the boardwalk?
Yeah, the tide was, you know, getting higher every year. And so, and that was fantastic when they started to change it when we were at school. And when we came home and, wow, the boardwalk is gone, and going into gravel, and sewer lines were coming in, and water line.
What year do you think that was?
At that time, we were in school, the 50s, 54, 55, 56 to 58, things started happening. The outhouses were being eliminated.
I bet that was a special thing.
I know, right? When the pipeline came in and stuff like that, they all through, everybody had outhouses all along the. So when the tide came and it took it all out, when the ice would be 3-4 feet thick, and they would take the outhouses right with them, you know. But, tremendous amount of change.
Do you know where the material to build the road, where that material came from?
Like I said, you know, there's evidence. There's evidence all along the shores here, all along our shorelines, amongst the islands and stuff like that. A lot of our boys, you know, would harvest the logs and tow them over to the sawmill. We had sawmill, you know, here, and they would use the material right from the sawmill. And some of it came from Wrangell sawmill. Because like I said earlier, you know, when we're renovating these houses, we got marks on them saying that, you know, Wrangell lumber yard. Some of the houses we renovated, believe it or not, their names still on there come from Wrangell.
Interesting. And how about the gravel to build the road? Do you know where that came from?
Okay, a lot of the gravel that was when the road started to go to Craig, you know, it only went halfway. They called Black Sand Point. And that was where they had dredges that went out into the channel and they would shovel it. And when they shovel it, it was just like coal. And a lot of that gravel came from there. Once they got the bridge established in the 40s, they got the bridge, finally got the bridge across. But I can remember when the bridge wasn't there and we used the rowboat to go across and walk to Black Sand Point.
Huh, so they actually, a lot of the road material came from
this
the dredging
area.
Activity.
This area, yeah.
This area.
Yeah.
Do you remember any stories about fishermen or barges bringing in road material?
Road material?
Yeah, like big boulders or gravel or anything. Do you ever remember stories of that, like that? No.
Yeah.
Remember those water and sewer lines? Do you know, have they been replaced before?
Oh, yeah. We participated in, before we went to school during the 50s, we participated on working on the water line. The hatchery, us teenage guys used to haul the pipes with the with wire. They came in on the mailboats and stuff like that, and we put them on barges and took them up to the bay, and we relayed them off the barge all the way up to the dam. All of them in the neighborhood of 12 people maybe, and we just carried all that pipe up, teenagers. It was like we had two boards like this and one board like this, and that board went into the pipe.
Mm-hmm.
And we had straps to the handle, and we just stuck it in there and carried it. They're 12 feet long, as long as this table.
Sounds heavy.
Yeah, in the neighborhood of 6 or 8 inches. You know.
Mm.
And we just laid them all up there, and they showed us how to connect them. We had to dig the ditches, we had to dig through the swamp to get them level.
Still pieces of that pipe up there in the escape.
Yeah, there's still some laying around there, you know.
Yeah.
And wow. It's amazing how everybody make a fire. We called one guy, he was the runner. He had a rifle, and when we got the pipes all connected, you know, he would run up and we're ready to connect it like this. See, it got in it, and we have to jump down on it, and we notify him with the rifle to, turn the water on. Because sometimes he'd take off and we couldn't get the pipe, and we had no way of, Charlie, stop, you know. And so we could hear the water coming. And sometimes we would lose on. Oh, water is shooting all over, and so we had to shoot and let them know it's not working.
Can you tell me about the Sand Point area?
The what?
Sand Point.
Sand Point
area.
Oh, yeah, it's those buildings. That building came in from came in from some camp out there. I can't think of it right now, but yeah, that was, they floated it in, left it up there, you know. That was a big store. It was a liquor store, it was a shopping mall for the whole community.
What kinds of things could you buy there?
Oh, you name it. Oil, gear, groceries, and rifles, you know, and clothes and stuff like that. And then it even had a little section for ice cream and hamburgers and a jukebox, and that was where we learned how to jitterbug.
Wow, so you did some dancing at the mm-hmm. store too.
Mm-hmm. Oh yeah.
Can you show me how to jitterbug now?
I put the old 50s on, you'd be out there.
Yeah.
But that was one thing that really helped us out in school, believe it or not. Yeah, when we got to school, there was a lot of kids, a lot of Eskimos, Athabascans, Simpsons, they didn't know how to jitterbug. So when we, hey, my God, that just opened up everything for us. I mean, the friendship and, the, you know, it just, wow.
That's at Mount Edgecombe, when you started to meet kids from all over the state?
Not knowing that this even helped us when we got down to Kansas, Lawrence, Kansas, when we got down there, that, jitterbugging was one of our key educational, wow, miracle. they just loved it. I mean, you know, they, and a lot of the other Indians down there, so-called cowboys would call them, they just stood it all beside us and didn't know. So that was my life.
So was the store a place where people would hang out and kids and adults would sort of hang out and listen
well,
to music?
It was, yeah. There's one section in there, a big stove. I could see a lot of the old timers would get together and talk about what's happening with the government. They would come back, like Frank Pradovich, Roy Pradovich, Elwood Mark, Jack Brown, they would, Sam Nicholson, they would all come in there and start discussing, this is what we've got to be prepared for, this is how we should be involved and stuff like that. A lot of that was taken, you know, they'd have coffee and just circle around the stove there. Then as for the teenagers, that little ice cream parlor, at one end of it was the gathering place for, and believe it or not, the lady that was in charge of it, she was the bank for all the boys. The bank. Because the guys would come in, they would make a draw over here, and they would make $200-$300 draw. And they would say, could you take care of my money? And she took care of the money for all the guys.
What was her name?
Bessie. Yeah. And she was a person that everybody trusted, you know. And she said, okay, James, I'll take care of your money. Here's enough for you to have fun tonight. That was what she did.
Well.
Yeah. So.
Do you ever remember when you were a kid and you're under the boardwalks looking for money? Did you ever find any stuff? Anything else like beads?
No, my mind was concentrating.
It wasn't shiny.
Because the tide would come up.
Mm.
The tide would come up and you had to get out of there. You know? So you only had so much time to get down in there.
Yeah.
And it was a lot of times we hid underneath there when we played snake. Snake was, you know, when we picked sides, a bunch of us would pick sides, and we'd go hide over here and we'd try to find everybody and tag them and till the last guy, and then, you know. But yeah, there was swim. Oh, yeah. We used to swim high tide there. It used to be so warm around here to swim. The outhouses were still aside. We just pushed the stuff aside. We never got sick.
Mm.
Because the water would clean everything out and stuff like that. So, oh yeah.
And were there boardwalks all over town? Is that how you got to your friends' houses, or were there trails?
According to the lady that got her husband to do it was Charlie Grant. Okay, the one in the big house right here. He was the big dude. He was the one that got this cannery, and you know, he had all the money and chickens and all that. But his wife came up to him at the home and says, if you want me to go pick up your mail and stuff like that, you're going to have to build me a boardwalk. Because the post office was way out the other end. And all walking through the, with the muddy and, you know, and she didn't like the idea of walking through the. So he said, okay, and then went and got the sawmill and got the boys and put them to work. And so they built a boardwalk all the way to the other end of the town.
And that is the boardwalk that then became Bayview Boulevard?
Mm-hmm. So this whole thing, yeah. Mm-hmm.
When do you think that was?
Probably in the neighborhood of, you know, the 40s, during the war, I think, or either after the war, something like that. Yeah. had to be before the war, 45, 43, 42. Oh, and then Sand Point, that board, that dock, Sand Point dock, okay, he put that in, and that was where the mailboat came in, and that was where we learned how to longshore during our teenage days. Yeah, we were 14, 13, 12, we used to go in longshore for the unload the boat and take it to the... They had three stores here. Sandpoint, Frank store, Bob Pradovich store, and Busy Corners. Yeah. Four. Five.
Where were they all located, all the stores?
Oh, they were Bayview.
All along Bayview?
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. From Sandpoint, and then we even had the bowling alley.
Hmm.
Yeah, we had the bowling alley, and the Woodses had their bowling alley. But from the Canary on, we had boat shops where they made boats, where they made rowboats, where they made oars, where they made commercial for the commercial. Harvest of the salmon. Roberts's, not the Roberts's, Anniskitz, Frank Woods, the Demerts, and the Roberts. Yeah. They had the Roberts on our island, and then come this way, we had right below your grandpa knows, they had one there.
They're by where the old Southeastern Army used to be?
Yeah, yeah. They had it in the neighborhood.
I've got this from 1965, so. And I've got these, if you want to mark anything on this map, and if you don't mind,
here's the cannery, yeah, we had a boat shop there, yeah, there was two of them, there was another one over here too.
What were the families' names who built boats?
Frank Woods, the Woods family, the Roberts family, which had one right over here. Yeah, see where this, there's a boat shop there that belonged to the Roberts family. And there's another one over here, right here, that belonged to the what's his name? Armor.
That was a boat shop,
yeah,
as well?
Yeah, right. So you had one, two, three, four. Yeah.
So was there another building next to this one?
Right down here?
Yeah.
There were just like company houses that belonged to the cannery. Small little houses that were established right there.
And were all of the boat builders building salmon seining boats?
Yeah, seining boats.
Are any of those boats still around?
Let me see. Boy, they're practically all gone now, I think. I think the Billy Nye was built in Craig.
Yeah, I think. Yeah, but...
I thought it was built here, the Billy Nye, which is still down the creek. Yeah.
And where, can you use the green and show me where the stores were?
Where the stores are?
Yeah, when you were a kid, where were the stores?
Okay, right here, Sandpoint.
You can draw on that if you want.
Yeah, right there, at Sandpoint.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. Frank's store, right here.
Mm-hmm.
Bob Predovich, right there. He owned all this right here. He had a big commercial store right there, along with a theater. Okay, and that burnt down during the 50s.
Mm.
Yeah, but you name it, he had the biggest commercial store in Tlahuac here. And they used to have a boardwalk come out here like this, and went all the way down to the cannery. Mm. That's the cannery. He had a boardwalk going all the way this way, and then all this way.
Hmm. And what were all the stores? Did they sell different things, or did they?
Oh yeah. Elwood Mark. He had he was just as almost big as what you call Bob Predovich right here at. When it burnt down the show hall and the store. So, and then Al was, vegetables and you name it, you know, all that came on this dock right here. There used to be a dock right there. And that was it right there. Our cannery was, went clear out here like that. Bob's cannery. Yeah.
When did these things start to either fall down or be burnt or go away?
Well, a lot of the destruction of the ice was took most of this stuff out of here. It was not being maintained and all that. But the ice was, like I said earlier, it was in the neighborhood of 3-4 feet thick.
Well?
Yeah, and so a lot of it came out and destroyed, sunk a lot of the boats that were tied up here. And there's the other boat shop that I talked about that along with Frank Woods, Leo Woods and them right there that belonged to the families. Over here that owned the bowling alley.
Where did folks learn to build the seine boats? Did they just make up the designs, or were the designs the ones that canneries gave them to make, just
knowledge
out of their head?
Just came out to their knowledge. Yeah, they started building canoes, and then pretty soon they started getting pictures of different boats and stuff like that. And instant knowledge. Yeah.
The canoes?
See all the, like I mentioned earlier, you know, a lot of the lumber, you know, was logged out from this island and different islands around the community, you know. So a lot of the, you could see where the big trees are, and they just took it to the sawmill right here. And this whole bay was full of logs.
And the canoes that they were building, were they dugout canoes, traditional ones, or were they?
Oh yeah, some of them were dugout canoes that come from this area. Yeah. See, we got yellow cedar and we got red cedar down in our area, which is in our advantage. Farther north or southeastern Alaska, they didn't have that. And here's my house.
When you were a kid or today?
Right there.
You can mark it green if you want. Is that where you live today, or is that where you grew up?
Oh, here's where I live over here. I got the biggest property right over here in this area. But, so.
And when you were a kid, Did you play all over the area?
Oh, of course, yeah. We had, you see there's a pond right here?
Mm-hmm.
You know, the pond only got about that deep, and oh boy, that was hunky dory. No big rocks, it was just all mud, you know, you know, walking the mud. And that was our swimming pool. And there was a culvert. The road wasn't there yet. But there was a boardwalk that went across here, and that was how we it was a pretty good sized culvert, and we used to crawl through it and go through it and eat the little minnows. The older boys used to come along and tell us, if you eat it, you'll be good swimmers. So we were convinced, and so we ate it. But oh yeah, that was our and then right down in here was our little playground for nighttime baseball.
Oh,
we
had,
you know, and we used we didn't have ball. We had wool socks rolled up and tied in a string, and that was our baseball field right there besides our baseball up here by the school ground. Yeah. The park. God's sake, the park wasn't even... Yeah, there's the park right there. But that was our play area. Cops and robbers and cowboys and Indians.
Do you remember... And what happened after the 1964 earthquake? And I heard that there was a tsunami, but not like we think of as a big wave, but there was a really high tide and damaged
right.
some stuff.
It was, I was in California at the time, 64, I was down there working. But I was talking to my niece, who was our administrator here. She was telling me that, yeah, the tide came in. And the tide came in and just flooded this whole bay here, but it was so strong coming in, it broke the boats loose, and some of them managed to get in there and just fight the tide. They were fighting the tide. And that sucker came in so fast, and the roads were all, you know, water.
Mm.
And my niece was one of them that, in this area, where a lady grabbed her and, you know, was holding her, and she almost went with the tide.
Wow.
Yeah, so it wiped out a lot of the houses, and believe it or not, some of them stayed. The piling
mm-hmm.
was sturdy. It made it. Yeah, but everybody came up to the school ground here, and my dad was coming across, and he was up to his knees in the water and managed to make it up to the hill.
Wow.
Yeah. This hill over here, yeah. He come through this way and made it up.
Can you tell me about any of the place names of the area? Like what? Were any specific place names you can remember?
And name?
Yeah, I heard that this was called Chuck's Island. Is that what?
On this side.
Oh, I got it wrong. Where's Chuck's Island?
Yeah, see that you haven't got the picture.
Right.
It's over here.
Mm-hmm.
Chuck's Island. Yeah, that was where the cannery was.
The first one.
Yeah, the first cannery.
Mm.
And he had a little house, no matter, big house,
mm.
right at the end of it, and that was where. Yeah, he was the last one, so they named it Chuck Sound.
Oh, his name was Chuck?
Yeah.
Who was the cannery operator? Or?
No, he was just, believe it or not, he was more educated than his brother, Frank Pranovich.
Mm.
Frank Pranovich was, you know, and he was smarter than Frank Pranovich. And Frank Pranovich was our senator for the community at that time.
Mm.
Yeah. And he was a smart man, but alcohol took the best of it. And Frank, continued his education and became a senator.
Mm.
Yeah.
And how about this island? What's this one called?
We call it the Islanders. That's what we called it, you know.
Mm.
And believe it or not, there, at the time, there was 25 homes established on this baby. The road, like it's, let me see, the road went like this and went up and went over, yeah. But on the original map of the city, there's a road that goes clean around on the water side, goes clean around like that. And there was homes, 25 homes. Yeah.
Do you think you'd see that road if you walked out there today?
Oh, yeah.
Yeah. It's still there?
Oh, yeah.
Hmm.
So, but covered, a lot of covered now. But there used to be the boardwalk, like I said, went across to Chuck's Island.
Hmm.
And a lot of times that was underwater.
How about, did this part of town have a name?
Right here?
Hmm.
Oh.
Or in here.
We just call the boys Uptown Boys.
Uptown Boys.
Right. And then the end of the road gang.
Okay.
Yeah. Because we used to challenge them, you know, basketball, hide and go seek, or, you know, stuff yeah. like that.
So your team was always your teammates from your, where you lived, the island?
We were the Islanders.
Yeah.
Yeah. And these guys were the end of the road gang, and these guys were... city boys.
City folk. and this area is Sandpoint. How far did, in your mind, does Sandpoint extend?
How far does Sandpoint?
Yeah, what would you consider to be Sandpoint?
Oh, this whole section right here.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, this whole section plus the houses. They own the houses, you know. So all of this right in here, you know, right now it's under new ownership.
Mm.
I understand they sold that to the Demers, but yeah, they went clean up, and they also took care of the, there used to be a little float here, and that float went down, just like that, for the airplane to come in.
When was that there?
That was Airlines, Western, you know, those guys.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm. And how about this end of town, did that have a name?
That was it.
That was, oh,
yeah.
Town ended here?
No, the town went from here to there.
Oh.
And these guys were...
They were all this, that was all
city,
the city.
Boys.
Yeah. Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
How about over here, this side?
Oh, this side over here. Okay, that was Second Kennedy, I think it was. You missed this part over here, but as you can see, there used to be a boat float right here. It came out, and that's where a lot of the boats tied up in the cannery went this way.
Mm.
And we used to, believe it or not, we used to go in there and play in the cannery. And they had the cannery discs, and we used to, we would throw them from the cannery that was established. We would try to throw them across. It was all
fun. Did you ever make it?
Sometimes. Yeah. But yeah, all those houses over there were, you know, belonged to the cannery over there. And some of the private people moved there. But that was the best garden right there. That was the best garden in the whole community, but belonged to Domus.
Why was it the best garden to have the best soil?
That guy knew how to take care of the soil.
Yeah.
I mean, he had carrots that long. Herb potatoes. And, onions, you name it. He, right there. Because when the sun came up, the sun hit him from 9 o'clock in the morning till 4 o'clock in the afternoon. And so... And he used a lot of the seaweed, the kelp, starfish, guts and stuff like that for fertilizer, which come from the cannery.
Do you remember the much about the BIA school?
Bureau of Indian Affairs?
Mm-hmm.
When we moved to Mount Edgecombe in the 50s, okay, like I said earlier, we were, you know, we were territorial. And we went to the school, the public school, okay. Then, in the 50s, when we went to my day, my brother and them were the first ones to be, there was quite a few from Tlaloc and Craig and Heidelberg that went to Wrangell during the 40s. And they were the first ones to go to boarding school. We were the second. We were the second generation to come there. Second or third. My sister went there, and my older brother. So I think we were the third generation to go to the boarding school, BIA. And believe it or not, when the supervisor in Mount Edgecombe asked us, could you give us an input of how you felt about Mount Edgecombe? And he says, I'm going to be speaking at a commencement. And he says, I want to get you guys this input. I said, really? He said, yeah. I said, okay. Right off the top of my head, I said, I thought we were in heaven. And his mouth dropped, and he said, heaven? Could you explain? I said, oh, heck yeah. I said, you know, never did I ever see so much food. Never did I ever see so much milk. And, you know, we didn't have to go in a rowboat to go look for our food. We didn't have to go down the beach and cut wood before we went to school. We didn't have to pack water anymore. Never did I ever see so much showers and toilets. Because, like I shared with you earlier, we had the outhouses. We still had outhouses in the 50s when we went to Mount Edgecombe. So he kept on going, slow down, Jim, slow down. He kept on telling me, slow down. I said, you know, you tucked us in. We had our own bed. We changed the linen. You know, we changed the linen two, three times. And I said, we had our own light. I said, you know, this was heaven. And we didn't have to pay for it. All we had to do was learn. Get up early and learn, you know. And I said, wow, I never saw so much beautiful woman in my life. You know, there were so many girlfriends. Because here, you, if you went with somebody, they would come and look, you're crazy, that's your relation. You can't go with her. And that was what was told with all of us, you know. And so we developed I don't want to go with her. She's my sister. So when we got there, wow, I mean, we saw all of this and it was all available. Take it. Yeah. So that was why I said, you know, we thought we were in heaven.
How old were you when you first went there?
14, 15.
Hmm.
Yeah. Freshman. Yeah.
There, and so did your home here on the island, did it have electricity then?
I got a picture of my dad and Bob Predovich standing in the corner of our house and my sister holding my youngest nephew. Yeah. They were all standing in the wood stove. The wood stove there, and man, when I see that I just I'm telling you, we're poor. We had cabinets. We had cabinet apple boxes. Yeah, we didn't have no running water. We didn't have no toilet. and we had to pack water. And so it was a miracle for us guys that left to walk to go to Wanishkum. Your dad knows.
Yeah.
He knows.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Have you found any beads or things that look like this around before?
I never did really get into this. Like I said, you know, we were commercial fishermen, and we're learning how. Matter of fact, this big metal building down there, before it collapsed, or before it was constructed, we built a new one out there, and this is where we started our construction. And watching these guys, my relatives, I used to visit every one of those boat shops and look at how they were taking care of the lumber to build a rowboat, to build a boat, and all that kind of stuff. I used to go down there, and I was fascinated by that. And so when I got to Mount Edgecombe, they gave us a choice of all the things that they could, from airplane mechanic to cabinet making to plumber to welder to electrician to, you know, it was all there, and we were looking at it, and they said, you got 2 weeks to make your mind up. And I picked the biggest construction part. Here was a house being built. And I said, that's what I want to be right there. And so this kind of stuff, I didn't, you know, I wasn't meant for that. So I didn't concentrate on that kind of stuff.
And you never saw anything like that?
Oh, there was a lot, yeah.
Oh.
I saw a lot of it.
Oh, where did you see it?
Yeah, my grandma, God, there was a lot of houses that had them that
had beads and
stuff like that, you know, making blankets, making artifacts and stuff like that. Oh yeah, that was their pastime. Besides our uncles and our aunts, you know, our aunts, grandmas were sewing, constantly sewing, you know, making different designs on our clothes and stuff like that. And our uncles and dads either carving totem poles or carving some kind of a tool to go harvest, you know, like making yane sticks, making hooks for halibut jigging, making, you know, things to harvest the berries and stuff like that.
And that is what people would be doing at their homes, this activity?
Right. No, there was no TV, no radio. But and then during the war, people started getting radios, and that was what, boy, we went to the grandma's house and listened to the big radio. Excuse me.
Can you tell me about the fisheries and the canneries and people coming to Klawak to work in the canneries, or people coming and fishing in this area, and any stories you know about that?
I could remember when we were side-drinking is, you know, it's in the neighborhood of a 40-foot boat with a open skiff, we call it, right alongside. Okay, and that was what we were taught. And right here, matter of fact. And I could remember when we couldn't even get Caucasian to participate because of the price being so cheap. The salmon was only 2 cents. And, you know, we try to get outsiders to, you know, they wanted to come fish with us and stuff like that, and some of them didn't want it because it's too cheap. I can remember that. And then pretty soon we start concentrating on the Filipinos and Domas, and Filipino. He furnished us with all the vegetables and stuff like that. So, and the fishing was tremendous. I mean, there was so much. There was so much all over. Our top fishermen, like those guys right here, would go out here in the channel and catch 50,000, you know, and they were, this cannery was just going constantly. So, we were taught how to rob a creek. I mean, you know, we didn't have no power skiff, we didn't have no speed boats, we had oars. And when we got in the skiff, they'd tell us to throw an anchor overboard and tie it to the skiff, and then we'd make a set. And that was how we held the other end of the net. So when they ready to close up, we just let the anchor go and roll like hell towards the boat. And, you know, we already had so many minutes to get all of that fish in the boat and get the hell out of there because of the fishing game. And a lot of them, you know, didn't have no speed boats and stuff like that, you know. So we had that advantage over them. But yeah, we were taught very early in a neighborhood of 9, 10 started to participate on the boat. So.
And the people who would come and work at the canneries, how did they mix in with the town of Kluwak, or did they?
Well, at first they were kind of against the Filipinos coming in. They were kind of, you know, because they were, you know, they were talking their language and stuff like that, and we couldn't tell whether they were talking behind us and stuff like that. But this building was established for them. This is where, when you walk past it, man, chop suey, you name it, chicken pie, oh, they were just the best cooks in the world. And but we got along with them, and you know, we soon start marrying into them and stuff. So, but they were brought in from different places.
Well, I think that for the most part that is my questions that I have. But is there anything else that you think I should know about, or you want to tell me about, or anything else that you think
you
can remember?
Well, you know, we just want to be like Art Demmer. You remember Art Demmer?
Yeah.
He's my teacher. We were in the 4th, 5th grade and stuff like that. And he used to come out and he used to tell us, he said, almost every day, he would tell us, don't forget where you came from. Don't ever forget who you are. Don't ever forget your culture. Don't ever forget your language. He would tell us that every day. So we had native teachers that, you know, all the Demert boys, and practically they're all gone now. But when we were growing up, they used to tell us that. They coached us in basketball, they coached us in commercial fishing and how to survive, how to conduct ourselves, you know, and stuff like that. And so coming into society and all that, and finding out, wow, that toilet over there is only for the blacks, that toilet over there is for the Indians. No Indians, no dogs allowed. You can't speak your language. This is what, besides all that stuff we saw in Manicum, there's restrictions. Yeah. And the restrictions pertain to, you know, wow, that's our culture. I couldn't, when they send us food, you know, dry fish, smoked fish, berries and all that, we couldn't eat it in the dorm. We had to put it in the storage and eat it on weekends. Yeah. So you see, and then the religion, when the religion, they were telling us what church to go to and all that. Okay. So, and when we were looking at the commercial sailing boats and all that, yeah, it was like looking at Michael Jordan, blah, 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 you know. Wow, that just really impressed us and stuff like that. And the teacher would say, you boys close that window and stop looking out the window. Every time you guys look at the window, you guys get excited and you could lose concentration. What are you here for? And we're trying to tell her, we're commercial fishermen. We're not loggers. We're not, you know. But the whole thing was like, okay, I'm gonna teach you how to become a Tinket instead of a Caucasian woman. That was what they were trying to do to us. And then I was, whoa, you know. And I didn't only see it there, I saw it when I went to high school. Now, mind you, 18, 19 years old, going across the country on Great Northern, the plate, you know, was, my heart was up here. I was scared. But I had a schedule and took me all the way down there. And the experience in that was, wow. Even the natives down there, even the natives thought, hey, you blubber eater, you Eskimo. Come on back up there, you know. We were treated like that. And like I said earlier, you know what broke the ice? The jitterbug. When we were learning how to jitterbug with their girlfriends and stuff like that, you know, hey, it was awesome. I mean, I couldn't believe it. That was our weapon. So, but, you know, learning how the kids felt about us and learning their culture, I thought we were going to die. I thought we were the heat and the flat land. I mean, we look out here, we could see water. We could see trees and stuff like that. Down there, you could look 20, 50 miles and don't see a tree, you see. And so that was kind of, but we stuck it out. And, you know, we said, so we're not going to leave. We're going to continue. Then we start finding out, whoa, our uncles went here. Frank Predovich, Roy Predovich, Billy Chuck, those guys. And when we got down there, there were six of us sleeping in this one section. And they came out and they said, this is a famous room. I mean, those buildings were all rock, old style. Wow, are we going to live here? You know, but there was history there. And they said, Jim Thorpe slept here. Oh, man, we looked at each other. So we said, I wonder which one's going to get his bunk. Believe it or not, it was Billy Mills. He was there with us. We had one kid from King Cole, Bristol Bay, and they were both runners. They were both runners, and they trained every day. They went up to KU and trained, but they slept in, and they said, well, I wonder which one of us is going to get the famous bunk. It was him. Here he come out to be an Olympic star. When he went to Tokyo and he won the 210 meter, he won the medal, gold medal. The world about come apart. So anyway, we were, geez, we said, that's our roommate and all that, you know. And when he became famous and traveled all over and saw reservations and stuff like that. I saw him in Montana and says, "Hey Billy, remember me? We used to share donuts and stuff like that." He was just hug. Yeah, so yeah, that was what we experienced. And when we got to our construction after we left school, we ran into a lot of discrimination. Everything. Like, "What are you doing here? You know, Indy, you can build teepees?" Stuff like that, you know. And, "Hey, damn Indians can't handle your drinking and all that," you know. It was just, bought my first house down there, and there was a petition going around. Come knock on the door, and they asked me if I could sign that petition. And I read the petition, and it said, "No Mexicans, no blacks, no Indians allowed." So it was stuff like that. So I had to put up with that. We had to work twice as hard to prove ourselves. That, you know, just like the Indians in New York when they were climbing those high rise, we experienced the same thing. We were working on high rises, stuff like that, freeways, and you know they'd come along here, and so we'll show you. And here was the advantage. When we had the training up there and the training over here, and when we got to the construction site, we knew what the boss wanted. We knew how long it was going to take and stuff like that. Bingo. We hit it off. Yeah, it was quite the experience. And one Russian, I think it was a Russian, him and I were working together, and he said, "So, well, what are you going to do now?" You know, and I said, "Well, I don't know, I have to look for another job." I says, "You ever think of going back home and work for your people?" I said, "No." He said, "Why?" I said, "I don't want to go back to no welfare place." And that worked on me, you know, and I started working with a young generation down there. And I said, "Hey, okay, I'll go back home." And I came back home. When I come back home, now I know how the military boys feel when they come back from the war. Wow. I came home here. "Who the hell think you are? You think you're so self-righteous that you know it all?" Huh. And that's what I experienced. But, you know, like they tell us in church, you can't concentrate on that negative stuff. You have to concentrate on the positive, what's good. And when I first came, I thought about all the swimming we used to do with the outhouses growing up. Now we got water. Now we got roads. Now, my house, when I bought this house right here, next door was a water treatment sewer plant. Yeah. What in God's name were you guys thinking? And they ran that, waste out into the bay here. For God's sakes, I said, this is our migration. This is where our species come by. This is where...
Biggest crabs in the bay.
Biggest. Oh my gosh. And so I said, no. So I got on a city council, I campaigned, and I got on a city council, and that was one of the first projects, me and another classmate.
And where is the wastewater treatment now?
Way out here by the sawmill, going into where there's a current going back and forth now, out in the channel. Yeah. So you see, those were the things that we fought for water, sewer, and you know, protection of the for the community, like ambulance. And we fought for the my cousin Alicia Roberts. She was our first nurse for the community. She used to deliver, go and take care of the people. And with her little handbag, and sometimes rode a crate to take care of people. The people, her husband would row her down the crate to take care of her. And so, you know, the big issue was, protection and health-wise, let's get a clinic. So we fought for that clinic and under her name, and by golly, we got it. So you see, from water, sewer, to clinic, to the only thing now we're missing now is McDonald's, huh, Nick?
Just their French fries.
Wow, excellent. Well, thank you so much for sharing your story with me. No, I'll keep listening. If you have more, I'll listen all day.
I think we, you know, now that we got all the organizations established, you know, I'm just honored to be with Nick here. You know, he's my relation and stuff like that. And our whole goal right now is to make our community better. Society is moving real fast now, and we're trying to keep right on top of it. And, you know, right now, like we mentioned, one of the biggest issues that's coming to our island is the tourism. And, you know, with all of us on the same page, we can participate. Otherwise, you know, and we can't stop them. There's no way in the world we're going to stop them, because our island is growing. We've got a beautiful country and all that. And, you know, like I said earlier, you know, our young generation is going to say, Grandpa, why didn't you guys protect it when you had a chance to? So, you know, that's what our goal is try to preserve, protect, and participate big time. Right now we have people sleeping in the bushes and stuff like that. It's not right. So we're trying. I know Nick heard a lot of times about this and stuff. Our students are getting educated to where they could go to the moon and come back. But if the lights go out, they're lost. I mean, they're lost. What are we going to eat? What are we going to... You see? They got no heat. They got no lights. They got no water. And they panic. So what we're trying to do is we're trying to educate them to where, okay, the lights go out. Okay, next step is, you know, you're going to find some lights and stuff like that. You're going to find food. You're going to find how to survive. That was the way we were taught. When I mentioned you early, to get to that boat, you're going to learn first on this boat. I'm going to teach you how to handle yourself and conduct yourself, and I'm going to show you the countryside before you get on that boat. And that was the way we were brought up. So our kids nowadays is getting educated, but go out and tell them to go out and get some sea cucumbers. Go out and tell them to go get a halibut. Go out and tell them to go get some greens and stuff like that, berries and stuff like that. How to put up fish. How to start a fire when you're all by yourself. None of that, you say. So what we're trying to do is try to include that. To where not only you're going to learn how to be computerized and stuff like that, you're going to learn how to protect and when I heard my dad, he said, you're only going to go up there to creek to get this species, and you're only going to get so much. You're going to come back.
Quick lunch.
Don't overdo it.
Okay.
And you protect that creek. What do you mean protect the creek? You couldn't realize what he was talking about and all that. I got to school and started learning a little bit more. That baby right there, that creek, will support this community. Yeah.
Still does.
And it still does. Yeah. So when we see issues like that out there, that bay where they got the big ponds, to where only certain species are going to be pumped into that baby for the commercialized, whoa, what about our protection?
Hmm.
Our, you know, and then lack of, could we put it out there? What do you guys think? Respect, okay? They should have came to us, talked with us, because, you know, anything like that, will it ruin the species coming in? You got the species, you're controlling it and stuff like that. Our ancestor says, no, you know, let them go, let them come. And then, you know, protect it. But the Forest Service, fishing game, we want them to come here and talk with us. That's respect. Now that we're organized and stuff like that, they're federal recognized. Hey, let's talk. Yeah, name of the game. Right, James?
Yep.
Because yeah. James, you'd probably be next in line for Nick when Nick retires.
Geez, I hope so. Maybe better bring me fish. We work with, when I was walking by, it was Elwood Thomas and Bill Woods. Get in here. You need to sit down and pay attention in here. And I was 9 years old.
Yeah.
I went in and listened to the AMB meeting, and I had a little bit of knowledge, or I kind of understood a little of the things they were talking about, you know, but it was just the way they conducted business.
Exactly, exactly.
Worked together.
Yeah, yeah.
Yep, so these gentlemen have passed on. They'd probably be 90 years old, right, you know, to this day, you know, just to give you an idea how long ago that was. So it's a lot of it starts with the AMB, you know. They're really not proactive, you know, but they do teach. There's a lot of mentoring in there as far as voicing, identifying, resolving. So pretty good.
One of our oldest traditions is, Christmas time. We're the only one in southeastern Alaska that puts on the biggest Christmas program in southeastern Alaska. And we opened the doors to everybody. And this place is just full with Christmas presents, where a kid will get one or two presents, along with a big bag of candy, along with getting a picture with the president, with Santa Claus.
President Claus.
May as well be friends.
So it's
on time. Everybody in town get down.
So,
you know, I read in one of the historical documents, it was maybe a teacher or possibly a missionary here, I can't remember, but in, I think it was 20s or 30s, talking about one of the trees in town that made the Christmas tree, and they put all these presents around it, and like that everybody in Quahog had come and put presents around it, and had this big exchange. It sounded pretty fantastic. If you were a kid, wow, that would be pretty impressive.
I mean, you talk with the kids that's coming from college now, they say they wouldn't miss it for anything.
Mm.
Yeah, they'll come home and they come to the gym and see everybody passing presents on, candy. And
so that's still, so every Christmas is still this Christmas tradition that the whole town gets together and,
That first
can
July
I come? That sounds great. I want to see it. It sounds fantastic.
It is. The entities too, the AMB and the ANS, you know, they set up the program, they set up the gym, and they decorate the city. Does fruit and candy bags, and then the tribe purchases Christmas gifts for the children and our elderly. You know, so they get one every year.
The elderly get a big bag of, you know, gifts and stuff like that.
Some children at the time go out harvest tree.
People hear about it island-wide, you know, they could get people here, for, you know, some of the families that have a tough time in the outlying areas, you know, Kaufman, Kovanakee, they'll bring their children in, you know, just due to the fact of tough times, you know, so it's island-wide, and You know, it's probably one of the most comforting times during the year. You know, just that everybody's together on a happy note You know, there to be there to support, you know, mourning or grieving of the lost ones. So.
Mm-hmm. You know, a big turkey. Every family member in the community gets a big turkey. So at Christmas time, everybody's eating.
Mm.
Yeah. And then ham.
Yep, we distribute turkeys on Thanksgiving down here. Mm. And then on Christmas, it's a real old-fashioned ham.
Yeah.
A 20-pound ham, so.
Wow.
New big one.
Where do you get those from? Yeah.
Grocery store.
Where did they get those?
About $7,000 worth of ham.
I mean, they must bring them in from Seattle or something.
Yeah,
right?
And then they deliver them down here to tribal purchase them and we distribute them.
Mm-hmm.
Wow.
And they're delivered to our elders, you know, so they don't have to come down.
Amazing.
Tribe does a lot down here.
Oh, big time.
Yep, very.
Yeah. This is what one of the elders said a while back. We're going to have to bring it back. A long time ago, they used to have get-togethers, you know, and just to get together, just to socialize and stuff like that, and share information pertaining to their survival and stuff like that. Because it was good for the young generation to. This way, we didn't fight amongst each other and stuff like that. And you know, they were getting educated in how we're going to work together, whatever, you know. And by these banquets, they call them, we would, the food. You got to be here to see the food that comes in. Oh my gosh. I mean, we got some cooks here, boy, I'm telling you.
Mm.
They would bring out everything, the best. Yep.
Mm.
And you go back for thirds if you want to. They were so, and every now and then we have a celebration, and that's what they do now. So, and when they have a disaster, stuff like that. But you gotta experience it yourself. You gotta.
It sounds like something experienced.
You gotta come and eat the food. We brought a bunch of dancers up from Montana one year and for the celebration of the totem pole. And boy, that was a big doing, remember?
Yeah, that was nice.
But when they came, they looked at the food and I don't know, but they put the dish, you know, and then when they were ready to perform, they knew me, and I had 6-7 dishes in front of me.
Yeah.
They gave it to me. And so they were embarrassed. They felt, you know, bad because they couldn't eat it. Yeah. So that's what you run into. And like I said earlier, there's a woman, Edna Pradovich, she was our teacher, and she was teaching us to conduct ourselves when we sat at the table or when we went to public doings and stuff like that. We couldn't put our hands on the table like this. We couldn't. She said we have to put our hands down here, okay? And all of the dishes and everything was stuff right there, and you know, you don't start eating until they pray, or either, you know, you're instructed to. And she was teaching us this manners when we were little guys yet, because we were going to Heidelberg Craig and walk basketball, and they would put on banquets for us. And I never forget that. Yeah. So our ancestors were preparing us not only to survive on the ocean, but to survive in the public. Yeah.
Mm.
So.
Hmm.
So you don't see that in school.
Mm-hmm.
You see them getting educated, but you come out and you ask them, what kind of manners do you use when you go to the public place? I don't know. You say, So.